Today is Friday, December 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. How quickly is France planning on searching mosques suspected of separatism?
These particular mosques is meant to be immediate. They're hoping to get it done within 24 or 48 hours.
Plus, the impact of the pandemic on least developed countries.
They've been able to export less, and their revenues are down, the tax collection is down, and their economies have suffered considerably.
And have you ever wanted to be Mario? We'll have these stories and more next. France announced on Thursday that it would start investigating dozens of mosques it said were suspected of fomenting Islamist ideology to combat the rising threat of religious extremism. Reporter Catherine Field is in Paris, and she spoke to me via WhatsApp to provide details.
President Macron has been really pushing this notion of France as a republic. That is what's important. And republic is secular. It has its own values, and they cannot be moved. And for that, he is also being pushed by the electorate to say, look, we've had two really abominable terrorist attacks in the last 6 weeks. One, three people were killed in a church in the southern city of Nice. And the other, a school teacher was beheaded outside of his intermediate school. So he is under pressure to move against what's being called separatism. These extremists who are operating in some mosques and prayer halls across the country, people who are preaching this idea that, in fact, these secular rules do not apply to them, and, in fact, they should be living by religious rules, and therefore creating what Emmanuel Macron, the French president, has described as separatism.
How widespread are these searches going to be? Because I imagine that there are thousands of religious facilities throughout France.
You're quite right. For the Muslim places of worship, there are some 2,600. But they have only actually targeted 76 of these facilities, 16 of those around Paris, 18 of them in an area just north of Paris, which is known as Saint-Denis, where there is a very large Muslim population. Around 700,000 Muslims live or go to Muslim places of worship in that area. 18 of the mosques which they have targeted could well face immediate closure.
Now, what has been the response within the Muslim community about Macron's statement about secularism and republicanism?
It really very much depends who you talk to. On the one hand, you've got the more, if you like, the more established mosques here in France that are run by people who were born here, who are children of migrants, but who really feel that they are part of French society. They live by these rules. They see that, yes, the form of French secularism means that they can only practice their religion within the mosques. There is no public arena for them, but that arena is protected. Then you get others, particularly some of those smaller mosques who have had trouble recruiting imams, recruiting helpers to come and make sure the mosque works properly, who have been, if you like, influenced by some of the more radical strains of Islam, which have come from abroad. So, for example, you have some mosques that have imams who have come from Saudi Arabia or Algeria, and they are preaching a very different type of Islam to the ones in the more established mosques.
Now, Catherine, one last question. This policy and program was announced on Thursday. And as you mentioned, they're looking at some 76 facilities. Have they put any kind of timeline on when they plan to carry out these searches and investigations and then in the program? Or is this more of an open-ended type endeavor?
These particular mosques is meant to be immediate. They're hoping to get it done within 24 or 48 hours. We're also seeing alongside this, of course, more deportations of foreigners who are in France who are accused of radicalizing young people. We've seen some 66 of those deported. So it's, yes, the closure of the mosques is straight off now, but we're looking ahead next week. We've got this all-important new policy that the French president is going to announce about Islamist separatism in France. We're going to see new rules coming in on that. And part of that is also going to mean that mosques may well have to close some of their preschool facilities, places where young children go before they head to school at state schools. they may well have to close those as well. So it's really part of an all-round program the French president is putting in place.
Catherine Field reports from Paris, France. And the nation is continuing to mourn the death of its former president, Valéry Giscard-Giscard. And Nicolas Pinault has this look at his life.
After several hospitalizations over the last few months, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing died on Wednesday at the age of 94 in his chateau, a 2 hours drive from Paris, according to his family. The former head of state left the public stage years ago, but the announcement of his death late Wednesday shocked and saddened the nation. At the French Senate, France's culture minister Roselyne Bachelot paid tribute to Giscard d'Estaing.
Je veux m'associer à l'émotion qui a envahi votre haute assemblée à l'annonce.
The minister said she feels emotional after Giscard d'Estaing's passing. She paid tribute to his memory as he led many reforms which still impact French society today. Giscard d'Estaing led France for a single seven-year term from 1974 to 1981, during which the country made great strides in nuclear power, high-speed train travel, as well as lowering the voting age to 18. It was also during his term that France legalized abortion. His seven-year mandate transformed France, President Emmanuel Macron said in a statement. Giscard was also active on the international stage at a crucial time during the Cold War. In 1976, he visited Washington to meet then-President Gerald Ford and address the U.S. Congress.
Is there a future for freedom in the world we are building for our children?
Europe was at the heart of his foreign policy, monetary union and greater cooperation. German Chancellor Angela Merkel paid tribute to former French leader on Thursday, saying, "France as a statesman and Germany a friend, and we have all lost a great European," in a tweet posted by her spokesperson. Deeply involved in the construction of a united Europe, Giscard d'Estaing expressed sadness at the announcement of a Brexit. This is what he said in one of his last interviews earlier this year to Associated Press.
In the world of today, where you are big structure, Chinese, the US of America, with the first economy of the world, Europe is too small. The changes will be in Britain. It's a very serious problem for them because they must organize their situation, their relationship, their diplomacy. I wish they will join.
Giscard's family said, according to his wishes, funeral ceremonies will take place in the strictest intimacy. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
U.S. President Donald Trump's effort to challenge his election defeat in Wisconsin has been rejected by the state's highest court. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has the details.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court voted 4-3 in its refusal to hear President Trump's lawsuit, attempting to overturn his loss to Joe Biden in the battleground state. The justices weren't ruling on the merits of the case, it was the process, ordering that it be heard first in the lower courts. The president's attorneys, citing the December 14th date for presidential electors to cast their votes, had been seeking a speedier process. Two of the justices questioned whether Trump's request to disqualify tens of thousands of ballots would be the right remedy if there had been irregularities. But another justice says the court is obligated to determine if elections officials complied with the law. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development reports the COVID-19 pandemic has had a devastating impact on most of the world's 47 least developed countries, whose economies have slumped to the lowest level in 30 years. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
In this year's Least Developed Countries report, UNCTAD economists warn the current grim situation will not improve unless the world's poorest countries drastically boost their productive capacities. They report average income is likely to fail in at least 43 of the 47 LDCs, pushing 32 million people into extreme poverty. Director of UNCTAD's Division for Africa and LDCs, Paul Akiwumi, says LDCs need to focus on their productive capacity to diversify their economies so they can deal with the challenges of climate change, recession, and now COVID. He says LDCs must build up their productive human, natural, and capital resources and entrepreneurship to provide goods and services. This, he says, will enable them to grow and develop their economies.
Now, it is quite clear that LDCs, being commodity driven, need to move forward in their development paradigm. And we've seen through the COVID crisis that because they're commodity driven, they've been able, and all the lockdown that has happened, they've been able to export less, and their revenues are down, the tax collection is down, and their economies have suffered considerably.
Akinwumi cites lagging international support as another problem. Because funding is down, he says LDCs have little money for social development and are unable to service their foreign debt. The report finds 8 LDCs, Bangladesh, Cambodia, Ethiopia, Laos, Myanmar, Nepal, and Rwanda, have modernized and transformed their productive capacities into better performing economic structures. It says Asian LDCs have increased their manufacturing capacity, which now accounts for 19% of their gross domestic product and 12% employment. The same cannot be said for African LDCs and Haiti. The report says manufacturing in those countries remains stagnant and accounts for only 9% GDP and just 5% employment. UNCTAD is calling on the international community to invest, finance, and support LDCs in their efforts to transform and rebuild their economies. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Greece has lashed out at Turkey, accusing it of pushing distressed asylum seekers into Greek waters, endangering their lives during risky sea crossings to Europe. Athens says such conduct highlights Turkey's failure to keep its end of a deal with the European Union to stop illegal migration. Anthi Karasava reports there has been no comment from Ankara.
Migration Minister Notis Midarakis voiced the accusation as crews from Greece's Hellenic Coast Guard recovered the bodies of two women, one of them 30 years old. They drowned after a dinghy packed with 32 other migrants capsized in high seas along the narrow strait that divides Greece and Turkey. The surviving migrants, including three toddlers, were Somalis, rescued in freezing waters off the island of Lesbos. Survivor accounts, according to Mitarakis, suggest that while Turkish authorities responded to a distress signal placed by the Somali migrants, they refused to offer assistance. Instead, the minister said, the Turkish Coast Guard pushed the craft into Greek waters, watching it sink. A response, Greece says, warrants a stiff response from the European Union. He says the notion alone of allowing safe passage to a vessel of this type that fails to meet fundamental safety requirements, the minister said, is inconceivable. But more importantly, Mitarakis told Parliament, such conduct violates a key 2016 agreement Turkey signed with the European Union, obligating it to stop illegal migrant inflows, not to facilitate them or imperil the lives of asylum seekers. Calls placed to the Turkish embassy in Athens were not returned. It is not the first time such accusations have been leveled against Ankara. In recent months, both Greece and Turkey have repeatedly accused each other of waging illegal pushbacks of refugees and mistreating them. Additionally, the United Nations Refugee Agency has called out Greece for allegedly underreporting land and sea arrivals from Turkey, a move believed to provide local authorities a free hand to conduct illegal pushbacks. Since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, migration has dropped drastically. But officials in Athens say the deadly sinking illustrates just how flawed and fragile the migration deal is, not least as Europe remains reluctant to get tough with Turkey. Under the deal, almost all migrants illegally entering Greece are deported to Turkey unless granted political asylum. With relations between the two NATO allies at their lowest point because of an energy standoff in the Eastern Mediterranean, all forced returns have been halted since March, and with refugee camps in Greece already overcrowded, even the drips and dribbles of migrants recorded in recent weeks are creating fresh problems. Greek government data released Thursday showed just 139 migrants deported to Turkey in the first 3 months of 2020. That's just a fraction of the nearly 15,000 who have illegally entered this year, adding to the more than 100,000 stuck in this country for years. Anthi Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
And coming up later.
Here we go!
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have found a number of possibly habitable exoplanets that reside in the so-called Goldilocks zone of their host stars. Researchers led by the Washington State University have discovered 24 exoplanets that may not only be habitable, but even more livable than Earth. A study published in the journal Astrobiology details their findings. The study authors say this collection of potential superhabitable exoplanets have suns that are better than our own and are more than 100 light years away. They found the planets have features that may make them more habitable, such as being older, slightly warmer and larger, and perhaps wetter than Earth. Study authors also found that planets orbiting slow-changing stars with extended lives could permit life to more easily thrive. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The United Nations Secretary General said Thursday that the damage COVID-19 has done globally will not be undone by a vaccine alone, and a full recovery will take years and even possibly decades.
Extreme poverty is rising. The threat of famine looms. We face the biggest global recession in eight decades. And these intergenerational impacts are not due to COVID-19 alone. They are the result of long-term fragilities, inequalities, and injustices that have been exposed by the pandemic. It's time to reset. As we build a strong recovery, we must seize the opportunity for change.
Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that, quote, looking ahead, the recovery from COVID-19 must address the pre-existing conditions it has exposed and exploited, from gaps in basic services to an overheated planet, end quote. Globally, there are more than 65 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, with the United States leading not only with the largest number of cases, but also fatalities. Now, as the United States struggles to contain the novel coronavirus with more than 14 million confirmed cases, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warned on Thursday that up to 19,500 people could die during the week of December 25th. Reuters' Lisa Bernhard is up next.
U.S. deaths from the coronavirus reached their second highest level ever on Wednesday, with 2,811 lives lost, according to a Reuters tally of official data, one short of the record from April 15th. That marks 2 days in a row that the death toll has passed 2,000. A record number of people were hospitalized on Wednesday, nearly 100,000, and there were nearly 200,000 new cases reported. The sobering data came on the heels of a warning from Robert Redfield, the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, that the worst is yet to come.
December and January and February are going to be rough times. I actually believe they're going to be the most difficult time in the public health history of this nation.
Underscoring the crisis, the CDC on Thursday reported that up to 19,500 deaths could occur during the Christmas week alone. Besides the monumental loss of life, Redfield said the country faces the prospect of a healthcare system strained to the point of collapse. The contagion has now reached every corner of the country, with 90% of all U.S. hospitals in areas designated as coronavirus hot zones, and with the virus spreading on a much steeper trajectory than any previous wave of the pandemic. President-elect Joe Biden on Wednesday amplified the bleak forecast during a roundtable with workers and small business owners hit hard by the devastating economic fallout.
We're likely to lose another 250,000 people dead between now and January. You hear me? Because people aren't paying attention.
Redfield projected the total number of deaths could be close to 450,000 before February, adding that the U.S. could start losing around 3,000 people a day, roughly the same number that died in the September 11th attacks, and that that rate could continue over the next 2 months.
That's Reuters reporter Lisa Bernhard. A U.S. government office set up to protect whistleblowers has ordered the federal agency that oversees Voice of America and other independent news networks to investigate allegations of wrongdoing by its own top officials. A December 2nd letter, signed by an attorney in the Office of Special Counsel, said the U.S. Agency for Global Media head Michael Pack is ordered to investigate after the OSC found substantial likelihood of wrongdoing based on details in whistleblower complaints. Since Pack's appointment to the U.S. AGM in June, network heads have been fired or resigned. Pack has stopped approving visa renewals for the agency's foreign journalists, and his political appointees have conducted internal investigations of reporters and editors. Ghana heads to the polls on Monday, December 7th, but as Stacey Knott reports from Accra, the familiar faces have made voter apathy an issue.
Ghana's government this week announced Monday, December 7th, would be a public holiday to help get voters to the polls to choose the next president. Despite more than 17 million registered voters and 12 presidential candidates, authorities are battling voter apathy with familiar frontrunners from the last two elections. Incumbent President Nana Akufo-Addo of the New Patriotic Party, NPP, is facing off against his predecessor, John Mahama, of the Opposition National Democratic Congress, NDC. Mahama won in the 2012 election and then lost to Akufo-Addo in the 2016 election. Kodjo Asante is with the Ghana Center for Democratic Development. He says there is fatigue, mainly among the middle classes.
The first few hours is always a good indicator of whether people will eventually go out. If they see that the crowds are behaving and then they get feedback that, oh, it's very easy to go and vote and so on, people might eventually still go out, even if they have decided not to.
Despite the challenge, Asante says their pre-election survey shows Ghanaians are concerned about issues such as improving infrastructure and employment. The survey pointed to positive responses on the ruling NPP's handling of COVID-19, power supplies and education. But the public was less impressed with Akufo-Addo's record on inflation, inequality and corruption. Attacking Akufo-Addo on corruption was a focus of Mahama's campaign, along with job creation. But risk consultancy group Songhai Advisory's Kobi Annan says both men have underperformed in office.
It's a difficult choice for a lot of people. Neither of them have performed fantastically during their terms in office. Yeah, I think it will come down to primarily sentiments around things like education, corruption, job creation. I think, you know, job creation and education in particular, those affect more people than day-to-day than corruption does.
Under Mahama's presidency, there was an energy crisis, corruption scandals and a currency devaluation. In 2016, the NPP won by about 1 million votes and with high expectations for Akufo-Addo to stamp out corruption. But in the weeks leading up to this year's election, the opposition NDC made corruption allegations against Akufo-Addo. Ghana's anti-corruption special prosecutor resigned just 3 weeks before the election, alleging political interference. While Akufo-Addo denies any corruption in his administration, analysts say it's hard to know if the claims will impact the vote. Regardless of the result or voter turnout, analysts are expecting Ghana's election to be fair and peaceful, as with the last two elections. Mame Jichi Jando is head of the University of Ghana's Political Science Department.
Emotions may run high, but based on these past precedents, this past good precedent, I believe that, you know, the elections will be peaceful and the result will be considered credible and legitimate.
The University of Ghana published a voter survey that gave the NPP an estimated 11% lead over the NDC, with 5% of voters undecided. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
Universal Studios Japan, located in Osaka, said it's going to open its new Nintendo-themed area on February 4th, 2021. The theme park had originally planned to open the area during the summer, but pushed it back because of the coronavirus outbreak. Reuters' Maha Albadrawi reports.
Here we go!
If you've ever wanted to immerse yourself in the world of Mario, Yoshi, and Princess Peach, you're in luck. The Nintendo theme park in Osaka is finally set to open on February 4, according to Universal Studios Japan. The area will feature Mario Kart races, attractions based on Nintendo games, as well as restaurants and gift shops. Executive producer at Universal Creative, Thomas Garrity, also revealed details on augmented reality features.
Guests boarding the ride will wear this augmented reality headset created by Universal's ATI group internally to meet the needs of the attraction. And this will immerse the guests in the world of Nintendo, where they ride right alongside of Mario, Peach, and Bowser.
Super Nintendo World was originally set to open in time for the 2020 Tokyo Olympic Games, but like the Olympics and many other events, was delayed earlier this year.
Maha Albajawi reports for Reuters News. China's space agency says its Chang'e 5 spacecraft has lifted off from the moon, and AP correspondent Jennifer King has the details.
The third Chinese spacecraft to land on the moon and the first to take off from it again. It's the latest in a series of increasingly ambitious missions for Beijing's space program. Researchers said the moon sampling process went smoothly and beyond their expectations. The craft landed on the moon's Sea of Storms on Tuesday, stowing samples in a container after working for about 19 hours on the moon's surface. The Chinese agency says the lander unfurled what they're calling the first freestanding Chinese flag on the moon. The ascent vehicle rendezvous with the return craft that's in lunar orbit. Touchdown is planned for the grasslands of Inner Mongolia in about a week. I'm Jennifer King.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a fantastic Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On Wednesday, October 28th, the United States Department of Justice charged eight individuals with conspiring to act in the United States as illegal agents of the People's Republic of China, or PRC. The defendants allegedly surveilled, stalked, harassed, and blackmailed U.S. residents as part of a global effort known as Operation Fox Hunt, to try to coerce these individuals to return to the PRC. Five of the defendants have been arrested in the United States. Three remain at large. With these charges, said Assistant Attorney General for National Security John Demers, we have turned the PRC's Operation Fox Hunt on its head. The hunters have become the hunted, the pursuers the pursued. Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI Director Christopher Wray, explained in a press conference what happens to Fox Hunt targets who refuse to return to China.
Their family members, both here in the United States and in China, have been threatened and coerced, and those back in China have even been arrested for leverage. These are not the actions we would expect from a responsible nation state. Instead, they're more like something we would expect from an organized criminal syndicate.
Fox Hunt is a global and extra-legal repatriation effort conducted at the direction and under the control of PRC government officials. The PRC's tactics include surveillance and intimidation, and the defendants are alleged to have engaged in clandestine and illegal conduct to force individuals who the PRC claims have committed economic or other crime to return to China. The United States' actions are not targeted at the Chinese people or with Chinese Americans, stressed FBI Director Wray. Our concern is with criminal acts committed at the behest of the Chinese government and the Chinese Communist Party. The FBI and its partners throughout the U.S. government will hold the PRC government accountable and protect U.S. residents from these reprehensible activities within U.S. borders.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.